The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true. But shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
Longtime listeners of the podcast know that we never miss an episode. In fact, until now, we hadn't missed a single episode in 15 years. So it was not an easy decision for us to suspend new recordings of the podcast during the COVID-19 crisis. On the bright side, this is an opportunity for us to revisit some of our favorite episodes from the archives. This week, I bring to you a conversation from the not-too-distant past, my interview with Robert Caro, author of The Power Broker and the in-progress five-volume biography of Lyndon Johnson. Bob and I spoke for our April 19th, 2019 podcast. Bob came on to talk about his most recent book, Working, but I had just finished reading Master of the Senate on my own, so we talked about everything. Here's the episode. Robert Caro joins us now. He is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of many books. His new book is called Working, Researching, Interviewing, and Writing. He is also the author of The Years of Lyndon Johnson, four volumes of them thus far, and The Power Broker, Robert Moses and the Fall of New York. Bob, thanks so much for being here.
Pleasure to be here.
All right. So everyone has been greatly anticipating Volume 5 of The Years of Johnson, but instead you have written this other book, Working, Researching, Interviewing, Writing. Why did you decide to do this?
Ever since The Power Broker, I kept myself out of the book. I don't think the word I appears in there many times. As soon as the book came out, people started asking me, what was it like to interview Robert Moses? And I realized that I should have put in something to tell people what that was like. So for like 45 years, I've been hearing that question. And people ask me what it's like to work in presidential libraries. What can you find out from interviews? This isn't advice to anybody, but it's sort of, I said, well, I want to give people some glimpses into how I work. So I took time out to do this book. Now I'm back doing the fifth volume.
I mean, it's an interesting question about interviewing Robert Moses, because you had, what, five sessions with him?
Seven
sessions with him, which was very different from the Johnson biography, where he was dead already for several years before you could get started. And I'm curious, you write about it a bit in Working, what the difference was like for you writing the book, writing a biography of a person who was still alive versus writing a biography of someone who was already gone.
In one sense, it's great to write about someone who's still alive because you get to meet him. Now, Moses didn't talk to me for the first couple of years of the book. Then we had seven interviews. As soon as I started asking questions, Pamela, the interviews were over. But they were long sessions, and I really got a look at him. With Johnson, you felt, oh, I came along just too late. He had died just 3 years before. What was great about him was that he died so young, he would have been only 67 when I started, he died at 64, that everyone was still alive. He had, I think, 12 people in Johnson City High School when he was there. They were all there to be interviewed. But you can't make up for not meeting and talking to the person you're writing about. You just can't.
Do you feel that absence in working on the biography of Johnson?
Yes. You do everything you can to overcome that. You know, you interview the people closest to him over and over and over again, constantly asking them, what was he like if I was standing next to you? What would I see him doing? So you try to get a feeling of him. Now we have these telephone transcripts where you hear him talking. You know, you have hundreds and hundreds of hours. You can listen to him talking and see how he deals with people and how he gets what he wants from people. That's what's always amazing to me.
Has that changed sort of the way that you've been doing your research, having access to those
tapes?
Yeah.
I think it should change the writing of history in general, like on the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which has been sort of a mystery, what really happened there, how many attacks were there on our destroyers, you know, that led Johnson to launch these large bombing attacks on North Vietnam. Now you actually hear the communications between Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, Singh Pak, the Admiral at Honolulu, and the commander of the fleet that's in Vietnam. You hear this in what was really going on in real time.
The other aspect of your interviewing that I thought was so interesting that you write about in this new book, Working, is the delicacy of interviews, and especially when you get to touchy subjects. And though you didn't interview Johnson for the book, you did interview Lady Bird. And tell a story about how you and when you approached the subject of Johnson's longtime affair with Alice Marsh.
Well, when Johnson is in the Pacific during World War II, he's in Australia, you're allowed one telephone call. The senator from Texas has just died. Johnson has to decide whether to run again for the House of Representatives or to run for senator. I'm going through all the correspondence, and suddenly, in the middle of it, there is a telegram from someone signed Alice. I've never heard of Alice. She appears in no book. And it says, Lyndon, everyone else, that happened to me in the White House. Everyone else thinks you should run for the Senate. I think you should run for the House. Please try to call Love Alice. I said, who is Alice? Who is this person that he makes the only one telephone call to and who's giving him political advice, which he follows? Shortly after that, so that's, you know, an example of going through the papers. By sheer luck, her sister and best friend show up at the Johnson Library and ask to see me. And I go down to see them and they say, you know, we want to tell you about a woman named Alice Marsh. We don't want to portray it as some bimbo. She was really very important in Johnson's life. And they told me the whole story of this long and significant relationship in his life.
So how do you then ask Lady Bird?
You know, Pamela, that's the only interview I ever had in my life where I couldn't bring myself to look at the person I was interviewing. Alice was a small-town girl, and she turned herself into this brilliant Washington hostess, brilliant meaning brilliant salons, and she came from a little town called Marlin. Now, no one would go to Marlin unless they were looking for information on Alice. It's a little town in the middle of nowhere. And Ina and I went up there, and we learned about her and how remarkable she was. But all of a sudden, we have a mutual friend who lived in Marlin who calls me in a panic and says, Bird, in Texas, everybody calls Lady Bird, Bird. Mm-hmm. Bird knows you've been in Marlin, so she knows you know about Alice. So I said, well, that had to be. That doesn't concern me. But her secretary then shows up at my desk in the reading room and says, Mrs. Johnson would like to see you out at the ranch this weekend. We had been meeting in her office. So we sit down at the dining room table. She's at the head of the table. I'm at her right hand, and my stenographer's notebook, like the one you use, is down on my right hand taking notes. And without preamble, she starts to talk about Alice Glass, how elegant she was, how sophisticated she was, how she taught Lyndon things, and everything that she taught him, he followed the rest of his life. You know, he had these long, when she met him, he was this new congressman, very awkward, with long, gangly arms. She said, turn them into an asset. Always wear shirts with French cuffs and very nice cufflinks. Mm-hmm. So when their attention is called to them, it's called in a good way. She taught him what kind of necktie to favor, Countess Mara's tie. But most of all, at crucial elements in his life, it was her advice that he followed, and in a number of cases, one in particular, it's not exaggerating very much to say she saved his career. This takes a moment to tell, but it's interesting. His early career is financed by a very fierce, huge Texas contractor, Herman Brown of Brown & Root. And Herman was prepared to keep financing his rival. And in return, Johnson was getting huge contracts for Brown & Root. When all of a sudden they had a falling out, Lyndon Johnson was getting them authorization to build a dam, which they wanted. But Lyndon wanted a low-rent housing project built in Austin in what was a very poor Mexican-American neighborhood. The houses in that neighborhood were owned by Herman Brown. The tenants were paying rent to him. They were very profitable. And he was enraged that Lyndon wanted to condemn them for his housing project. And his chief lobbyist and his chief lawyer talked to him and said, you know, Herman was about to turn on Lyndon. And when Herman turned on you, he never turned back. When Alice hears about this and invites them both down to her great estate in Virginia, she sits them down at her table and says, why don't you just compromise? Give Herman the dam and Lyndon the land. And all of a sudden, everything was okay. So Lady Bird starts talking not only about her elegance. She says, the quotes are in the book. She was so sophisticated, so beautiful. I remember her in a succession of wonderful, beautiful dresses and me in, well, not so wonderful. And then she said, you know, Lyndon always followed Alice's advice. During that whole interview, I have to say my head just stayed down and I took notes. I couldn't look at her. So that was done. Then the next week, we went back to our ordinary interviews.
So she just launched into it without you even having to ask.
Without a word of preamble.
Wow.
Yeah. I sometimes think I know something about politics. I'm really glad I don't have to write about women because I never understood why she did that.
So you had gone in there presumably thinking, how am I going to bring this up?
Yes.
And then you never...
I didn't have to. She talked. She answered all my questions without a word out of me.
You write in Working about the use of silence in interviews. And I'd love you to talk about that for a minute and then talk about the opposite, where you have to actually ask uncomfortable and sometimes aggressive questions.
The silence thing is interesting. If you looked in my notebooks where I take notes on interviews, you'd find the letters SU written very big sometimes. They mean shut up. It's because I tend to talk too much. And the thing is, if you're interviewing somebody, silence can be a real weapon for you because there's a human, seems to be a human need to fill a silence. So if you ask a question, if there's a silence, he's not answering it. If you can just shut up long enough, an amazingly large percentage of that time, he has to talk, and he'll give you the information you want.
But you're dealing often with people who are master politicians, who presumably also know sometimes the use of silence. And I'm curious, with someone like Moses, where you say, you know, he was a monologuist, and he talked and he talked. Did he ever use silence against you?
No, you didn't have to with Moses. With Moses, if you asked a question, he might answer it for an hour and a half. The thing about it was, you didn't want to interrupt. When I started an interview, as I was a young reporter, I had won a couple of really minor journalistic awards. But when you're young and you win anything, you think you know everything. I thought I really knew how political power worked. From the minute Robert Moses started talking to me, I knew that I knew nothing compared to him. I mean, it was like I had never even dreamed of this level of political genius.
I mean, it's such a tricky dance with access, right? Because with someone like Moses, he controlled access to a lot of the information and a lot of the people around him and to whether they would talk to you or not. I mean, did you worry that, if I make sort of one false move here in this interview with him, he's going to tell everyone not to talk to me anymore?
Well, it didn't happen quite that way. What happened was, see, over the years, many biographers, I don't mean a few, had started or contemplated biographies of Moses. And I suppose they were told the exact same thing I was told. As soon as I wrote him saying I went, two of his public relations, they always came in pairs. These guys was named Murray Davis and Edward V. O'Brien. And they basically said to me, well, you know, Commissioner Moses will never talk to you. His family will never talk to you. His friends will never talk to you. And then they had this phrase, I don't remember the exact wording, but what it meant was, no one who ever wants a contract from the city or state will ever talk to you. And you will never see his papers. So I had to think of something. So I drew a series of concentric circles on a pad. In the center, I put a dot. That was him. The first circle was his family and closest friends. Second was fairly close friends, people who dealt with him all the time. But there were outer rings. And I said, well, he can think of and make sure they don't talk to me, all the people who are close to him. But he's going to forget a lot about a lot of people on the outside. So I started with them, and as I later were told, he started getting these telephone calls from people saying, this young man came to interview me about you, Bob. So for 2 years, he didn't talk to me. All of a sudden, I get a phone call from his daughter, Jane. She called him Papa Bear. She said, well, Papa Bear will talk to you. Come out and meet him at Oak Beach. And I do not know why he changed his mind on that. I was told something. It's quite complimentary to me. But it's the only explanation I was ever given. I became very friendly over the years with his chief aide, a guy named Sid Shapiro. He said, well, you know, the commissioner realized with you that finally a biographer had come along who was going to do the book whether he wanted it or not. I don't know if that's true.
Mm-hmm.
But we had 7 interviews, which were an education to me.
And you ultimately did get a copy of all of his papers. You often talk about how your books are about power, about these two men who accumulated and wielded power in two very different arenas and sort of fundamentally changed the use of powers within those two different arenas. But as a reader, it strikes me that your books are as much about the powerless as they are about the powerful. And you start off Master of the Senate, for example, with a woman who cannot vote. It feels like your heart and some of the most moving passages are really about the people who didn't have the power.
You know, and when you deal with them that way, I'm so glad, that's so perceptive of you to pick that thing up, because it's an example. If you say, I'm not going to write just about the powerful, I'm going to write about the powerless and the effect that power has on them. So I'm trying to show in Master of the Senate, Johnson does what hasn't been done for 87 years. He gets a civil rights bill through the Senate that's controlled by the South. So that's quite a story. But as part of the story, I wanted to show exactly how hard it was and what happened to black people in the South in the 1950s who tried to register to vote. So I'm reading all the testimony that black people gave before the United States Civil Rights Commission. And, you know, some of these stories make you cry or fill you with rage. So I came across the testimony of this woman, Margaret Frost, who was humiliated with the questions she asked. But she didn't give up. She went home and studied. And about 6 months later, she went back before these same 3 registrars, and they humiliated her again.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, oh, I have this story. But the thing is, there's always more to the story. And her husband, in the course of her talking to me, she mentioned, just in passing, that her husband had registered to vote, David Frost. So I said, well, I'd like to talk to him. He didn't want to talk to me at first, but I eventually spoke to him on the phone, and he told me the following story. When he registered to vote, a car came by and men shot out with rifles the lights on his porch. He wanted to call the police, but as the car drove away, he realized it was a police car. All of a sudden, Pamela, you said, so that's what it was like to be a black person in the South. There was no place to turn, no one to protect you. So the whole story came, there was a whole other dimension to me.
I want to talk a bit specifically about Master of the Senate. Listeners of this podcast have heard a bit about it in the last few weeks as I was reading the book. And there are certain aspects of the writing in this book that I think you cover also in your new book, Working. And I want to talk about those different aspects. One is the sense of place, another, storytelling and pacing, and the third is the development of your characters. But sort of as background to all of that is the process of writing and editing, because with The Power Broker, we know that about 350,000 words of this book did not end up in the final book. I imagine that that is true as long as they are of books in the years of Johnson. I'm curious about what your process is like in terms of your relationship with your editor, Bob Gottlieb, and how that works.
Well, it's a long relationship. You know, he became my editor in 1971. That's 48 years.
Wow.
It hasn't been always a peaceful relationship. Let's say we're both strong-minded people. But he's a great editor for me. He's a great editor. And sometimes I think no one but he could have edited me. Because what he does, I mean, he's not going to let you go. If he makes a suggestion and you don't want to accept it, you're not going to turn the next page. He's going to tell you why you should change it. So in answering that, you have to think about what you did. That's very valuable to me because my books take so long. My publisher and my editor never bother me. So I'm sort of in a vacuum in a way. And it's easy to fool yourself that you're doing it better than you are doing it. But as you're writing this, you're forced to say, what would Bob think of this? Mm-hmm. Do you know? If you saw us up till this working book where things became friendly, it was one that took 45 years. But from the very first time, he's a guy who never used to go out for lunch. I never have lunches. We worked on that book. You know, the cutting out of the 350,000 words was really hard. And I think even Bob would say to you, we didn't do it just because they were superfluous. I think he said something like, we cut 350,000 really good words.
Yeah.
Neither of us wanted to do that. But we're so on the same wavelength. So in order to get enough money to finish The Power Broker, I had to sign a two-book contract. The second book was for a biography of Fiorello LaGuardia. So I finished The Power Broker, and I really don't want to do a LaGuardia biography. I covered this. I can't stand ever to go back and do the same thing again.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm saying, but you know, I realize now that what I was doing in The Power Broker was not a biography of Moses. It was a study of urban political power in cities, how real power works.
Mm-hmm.
When you're not elected to anything, what is the real power that you get? I said, I want to do that for national power. And I know who I want to do it through. I want to do it through Lyndon Johnson. And I never want to have to cut out words that I don't think should be cut again. I want to do it in volumes. I said, but Knopf, my publisher, will never let me do that. I'm under contract. So I'm sitting there starting the LaGuardia biography, and I get a call from Bob, and he says something like, listen, I know your famous temper. Bob is always saying, Bob Caro has a terrible temper, but I'm a very even-tempered guy. Untrue. Okay, it's two people with a terrible temper. So he says, I know your temper. I want you to come in and see me, and I don't want you to say anything until I finish talking. I have a suggestion for you. So I went in, and he says, I know you want to do this LaGuardia biography, but I don't think you should do that. I think you've done it all already. But I do have another subject that I'd like you to do. I'd like to suggest that you do Lyndon Johnson, and I think you should do it in volumes. So many times in our lives, all these years of editing, you say, although we really have bitter fights over some things, we're both sort of on a very basic level on exactly the same wavelength. And I'm grateful to have had him all my life.
That's amazing.
All my life, yeah.
Do you ever hand in to him parts of the book, or do you wait until it's all done?
I never show anybody except Ina. One exception, I needed more money when I was doing one of these volumes,
mm-hmm.
so I had to show what I had done. That's the only time. I don't show anybody anything until it's all done.
So I want to talk about, because you work in on the book in its entirety, about the structure specifically of Master of the Senate, because it's very interesting. There's been a big gap between this book and Means of Ascent, the second volume. And I was nervous as a reader going into it because I had not read The Path to Power or Means of Ascent in decades. So I thought, oh gosh, you know, am I going to be able to gain entry into this? And you started off in a very surprising way by devoting a little over 100 pages to the institution of the Senate itself, a kind of mini biography of the Senate and a kind of history of the United States as seen through the lens of the Senate. How did you decide to do that? And did you know from the beginning you were going to approach it that way?
No, not at all. I thought Master of the Senate, which is, I forget how long it is, but it's almost 1,000 pages. I'm looking
it's
at
a little it. Over 1,000 pages.
I'm looking at how big it is.
Yes, I know very well.
Well, I said, but as I'm doing the Senate, I'm the nut who sat in the gallery. You know, I'm up there all day. The tourist groups come in and out. I'm still there. The senators are looking up at me. Who is this guy, you know? But I'm realizing it's an entire world that I don't know. And in fact, a world that almost nobody knows. And it was really important at times in American history. And it's important to show Lyndon Johnson's genius, how he changed the Senate so that it really worked. The books are called The Years of Lyndon Johnson. That's because the books are not supposed to be about just Lyndon Johnson. They're supposed to be a history of America for perhaps 60 years. So I start writing this, and I said, this is a story nobody knows, and it's going to take, I suppose, 100 pages, maybe 60, 70,000 words. So I wrote it, and I said, well, I think this should be published. Where am I going to put it? If I start the book like this, nobody's going to read the book. And I tried to break it up and put it, parts of it at the beginning of other chapters, to italicize parts and put it into other chapters. Finally, I said, to hell with it. This belongs at the beginning of the book. That's where I want it to be. That's where it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
So I gave the manuscript to Gottlieb, and he said something like, you know, he said something complimentary about it. I don't get a lot of those. He said something, he said, you know, and that's the only place it should go, right at the beginning of the book. I don't think many editors would have said that.
So you start off with this first section about the Senate, and one of the things that struck me about this book is that while it's very long, the pace keeps moving because you keep sort of changing a little bit what it is you're doing. And you have these mini stories within the book and even mini biographies within the book. And I guess first, how did you decide, okay, here's where I'm going to kind of home in and tell maybe a small story, but blow it out to illustrate something versus I need to describe what happened, let's say, between 1955 and 1957?
Well, there's human drama. I tell the story of Leland Olds, a name that no one knew. I had read it, but I had no idea. So the beginning of this book, right at the beginning, Johnson comes to the Senate, and he wants to cement himself with the Texas oilmen and the Texas contractors. And up for confirmation is a man named Leland Olds, who had been on the Federal Power Commission, which regulates the oil industry. So it's mentioned in all the Johnson biographies that he holds hearings on Olds and paints him as a communist. Some of these books say he was a communist. Paints him as a communist and defeats his nomination. I said, well, I want to read the hearings.
Mm-hmm.
So you ask why the books take so long. Hearings are a lot of reading because there's a lot of extraneous matter. But woven through this hearing, I say, I am reading a story of a man, Lyndon Johnson, destroying another human being for political ends. I can't believe it. I mean, I remember reading these hearings all night, underlining them. I said, look what he's doing here. He takes this man who was a young man in his 20s, had flirted with the Communist Party and had written for the Daily Worker, and painted him as a committed communist and destroyed his life. I mean, Olds was a respected man. After that, he lived the rest of his life always struggling for money, shunned by almost all his old friends because it wasn't safe to be known to be his friends, and Johnson is doing this, and it's sort of horrible. So I tried to find everybody who was connected with it, and I found one aide who is standing. Johnson has just had a cross-examination of Olds saying, you know, do you still believe this? He would quote articles from the 20s. Olds would try to explain that he didn't believe it, but Johnson would cut him off. And there's a man standing with Leland Olds in the luncheon break for the hearings or recess break, I don't remember. And Johnson comes out and throws his arms around Olds and says, throws one arm around the shoulder and says, I hope you're not taking this personally, Leland. It's just politics, you know. So I said, I'm going to tell this story. When you say you're going to tell a story like that, Pamela, you know it's going to take a lot of pages if you tell it right, because mm-hmm. it's a human story, and you have to paint two human beings, Lyndon Johnson and Leland Olds. Sometimes you get a feeling that you've done the right thing. When this book comes out, I mean, no one had heard of Leland Olds anymore. I'm signing books. I think it was in Seattle, but I don't really remember. And, you know, you're sitting there, so there's you give a talk, it's a long line of people. All of a sudden, this voice says to me, I'm Leland Olds' granddaughter. I want to thank you for saving my grandfather's reputation. Well, I have to tell you, there are moments when you do these books that you feel good. There are a lot of moments when you don't feel good about what you did, but there are moments when you feel good about something.
Wow. I mean, you read that biography, and it is like a mini biography of Leland Olds. And to this day, I mean, if you go onto Wikipedia, he's got like three paragraphs. And what you do is that rather than start with the facts of the situation, which you, as you state, that, okay, here's someone for political purposes in order to win the presidency, in order to gain the trust and the money of this lobby in Texas.
Right.
He needs to defeat this nomination. Rather than start there, you start with, here's this guy, Leland Olds. And for a moment, the reader thinks, why are we talking about Leland Olds, who comes across as, you know, just a good person, a real idealist and public servant.
Yeah.
I thought that it was interesting that you did that, too, with other characters, other sort of mini biographies that appear in the book, that even someone like Richard Russell, you start off and we don't have a sense of Russell as a tremendous racist from the very beginning. We hear a lot about the good things that he did. And it isn't until it's almost novelistic what you do with the character development that you don't. The same thing with Eastman, who sort of flits in and out in the earlier parts. And it isn't until much later in the book that you realize this guy is a real repressive racist.
A hater of blacks. When you research, you read the newspaper articles, the New York Times, the Washington Post, Russell is held up as the beau ideal of a senator, the perfect senator. And in foreign affairs, he really is. He's like one of the great senators of Rome. When you read about him, you study his speeches, you say, this must be what the great senators of Rome were like. He had this worldview, American army should do this. It was a very intelligent and informed worldview. Then you start reading the congressional record, and you see, you can't believe the racism, the hatred that sometimes he's reading a speech that, you know, he's carefully edited, and the hatred comes through. And then you realize this is the guy who for 30 years kept the Senate. Someone said the Senate was the South's revenge for Gettysburg. Mm-hmm. Nothing can get through the Senate that Russell doesn't want. So I said, well, I can either show the power of the South in the Senate through giving the reader a lecture, or I can show it through doing a biography of the man who embodied that power, Richard Russell. I have to make the reader really see him. So what I did was I went down to his town, Winder. You know, I'm a Northeasterner, a New York person. No matter what you think about racism, you don't know it. So he was dead. He lived in this house. His father was a judge and a powerful judge. When his father died, Russell idolized the father. And he built an obelisk. You know, it's not a huge house. It's a nice house, but it's not a huge house. In the back of it, he builds an obelisk to his father. And on it, it says, lover of the old South, defender of the new. So you start talking, and one of the things you realize is it wasn't just that he opposed every attempt to make lynching a federal crime. There were two lynchings. You say, where was this lynch? You're reading the weekly newspaper, the Winder, whatever it was, and they talk, you know, very short. There was an incident on the so-and-so road, you know. So that's a lynching, you know, you're talking about. See, that's just down this road from his house. And then he had two nephews. The law firm, Pamela, was still called Russell and Russell. So I made friends with the two nephews. We were walking. I don't remember that the size walks were wooden. Maybe they were, but most of that town is not white. It's black. So it would be an exaggeration for me to say that anyone, we walked abreast, you know, mm-hmm. filling the sidewalk. People were coming towards us, black people. I don't want to say, because I don't really remember that happening, that anyone actually stepped off the sidewalk to give us way. But I saw the eyes of the people coming towards us, and they were ready to step off the sidewalk. And I just hated. I mean, you came back from that, you said, if you make a picture of Russell correctly, I don't say I did it correctly, it was very hard, I rewrote that thing. If you do it, you're going to show two things. The greatness of this man in foreign affairs, in directing the armies of the empire, let's put it in Roman terms, you mm-hmm. know, and the horror of this man in playing the leading role in keeping laws to help black people from passing for decades. And then you say, but Lyndon Johnson made Russell believe. Why did he raise Lyndon Johnson to power? Russell is the guy who raised Lyndon Johnson to power. Then you said, you mean Lyndon Johnson made Richard Russell believe that he believed the same way he did? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's quite a story.
You are famous for taking notes by hand, for writing your first and second and third drafts in longhand, and then working on a manual typewriter. Has technology in any way, there's so much that has been digitized and that's now available in video and readily accessible, has any of this had an effect on the way that you do your research and write?
It has had no effect on the way I write. I still write in the way you just described, in longhand and on a typewriter. It has had a terrific effect on my research because the computer makes research, like there were all these hearings. I'm doing Vietnam. Mm-hmm. The executive sessions of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee are I don't even know. There are thousands of small print pages. You really can't read it all. But with just say one thing, control find. You want to know yes. what Richard Russell, you know, said? That's easy. So, yes, it's helped me a lot in recent years.
Because you talk about those, you know, huge files just down in the Johnson Library. Is that now all digitized and searchable?
No, almost none of it is digitized and searchable.
So some of it still hasn't changed?
Most of that library hasn't been digitized.
Wow.
You just have to pick the boxes that you feel you ought to turn every page in and use them.
You start off this book talking about your experience as a newspaper reporter, mostly for Newsday on Long Island, where I grew up. And I'm curious about two things. One, what was the most important thing you learned as a newspaper reporter that helped you in your writing, in the process of writing these biographies? And is there anything that you had to kind of forget because it wasn't useful or it wasn't helpful to you?
Well, the most important thing I learned is what I talk about in working. The very first piece of advice, I was a new reporter. I'd never done investigative work. I had this old editor guy out of the front page. I was the first Ivy League graduate who had ever worked in his city room, and I was hired just because he was on vacation. They wanted to play a joke on him. He wouldn't even talk to me. Then I got thrown into it and doing something investigative. And he liked this memo I wrote. He said, exactly, I didn't know someone from Princeton could do digging like this. From now on, you do investigative work. I, with my usual poise, said something like, but I don't know anything about investigative work. And this old guy looked at me and he said, I've never forgotten the exact words. Just remember one thing. Turn every page. Never assume anything. Turn every goddamn page. And, you know, of course, you can't do that in the Johnson Library, but if you're doing a topic like the Gulf of Tonkin, it may take months, but you can do it. to turn every page. And over and over again, his name is Alan Hathaway. I've said to myself, thank you, Alan, because I find some amazing thing there in a box just filled with the rest of it is just innocuous stuff.
And was there anything that you felt like, you know what, you just had to kind of forget it from your reporting days?
Yeah. Working fast. People don't believe this anymore. I was a really fast rewrite man, but I never thought things all the way through. You don't as a daily reporter, to tell you the truth. When I started to write The Power Broker, I suddenly realized how complicated this was going to be, that I didn't understand where Moses got his power. There was so much I didn't understand about it. I was going to have to think things all the way through. So that's really the reason, Pamela, where I write my first drafts in longhand, because that's the slowest way of committing your thoughts to paper. I do a lot of drafts in longhand, and then I go to a, not a manual, but an electric typewriter. I don't want to write on a computer. Computer is too easy for me. It's too fast for me. I want to slow myself down.
All right. Well, taking a cue from your writing on interviewing, I've saved what is, for me at least, the most difficult question, because I know it's one that you hate getting. And so I'm going to try not to ask it in the most simplistic way. I know from your book Working that you don't like people asking you if you like Johnson. So I don't want to ask it in that way exactly. But perhaps two-part kind of question. The larger question is, do you feel like you get 100% at this point his character? And as part of that, do you find your sympathies with him sort of coming and going? I mean, he changed a lot, right, over the course of his life, and he was changed by the events of his life. I'm just curious how your sort of personal understanding and sympathies with him or against him have shifted over time.
Yeah, it's a great way to put that question. So I spent a lot of time, you know, with his brothers, his sisters, his classmates in high school and college, the guys who were in his first political machine. I felt I came to understand this character. It's a very strong character. It sort of formed in his terrible boyhood. You know, you can't really think about Lyndon Johnson's boyhood without wanting to cry for him, because it was a terrible, humiliating boyhood in this isolated town, which is the whole world. And in this town, his father, who was once the most respected man in it, becomes the laughing stock of the town. And his family they lose the Johnson Ranch. The father makes one mistake. They lose the Johnson Ranch. They're living in a little town in Johnson City, and every month they have to worry that the bank's going to take that house away. There's often no food in the house, and neighbors have to. It was humiliating and terrible. It's a complicated character. There's a deep well of compassion, and you see it when he's young, when he's a school teacher teaching Mexican-American kids. You see it when he's president and he gives the great civil rights speech, and his speechwriter, Richard Goodwin, says, do you really mean this? And he says, listen, when I was teaching those kids in Cotulla, I swore that if I ever had the power, I'd help them. And I have the power, and now I mean to use it. You say, that's a consistent strand. Then you say, this is a guy, braggadocio, super masculinity, used to refer to his private parts a lot in a very boastful way.
There's some great anecdotes about that in the books.
I'm not sure I'm going to repeat them on this one. But you say, and Vietnam, so much of it owes to that side of his character. But if you're really asking me, does my view of his character change? I felt before I started writing the first volume that I had done everything I could to understand this complicated character. And I felt that his life plays out. It doesn't play out in a consistent way, but it plays out in a way consistent with that character.
All right. Well, that's a very good and careful answer. And I feel like we'll find out more from that when we get to volume 5 of The Years of Lyndon Johnson. But also, there is really a lot of insight into that in this new book, which is a fascinating behind the scenes. The book, again, is called Working, Researching, Interviewing, and Writing by Robert Caro. Bob, it has been such a pleasure having you here.
It was a pleasure being here. Thanks.
Thanks. craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
So here's a request for our listeners. I get lots of feedback from you, some complaints, lots of kind words. Really appreciate it. You can always reach me directly at books@nytimes.com. I will write back. But you can also, if you feel moved to do so, review us on any platform where you download the podcast, whether that's iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play or somewhere else. Please feel free to review us and, of course, email us at any time.
This is Greg Coles, the Book Review's poetry editor. For National Poetry Month, we've invited poets onto the podcast to read a poem that's meaningful to them. This week, Reginald Dwayne Betts, whose most recent book was Bastards of the Reagan Era and whose next book, Felon, will be released in October, reads May 24th, 1980 by Joseph Brodsky.
I have braved for want of wild beasts, steel cages, called my term and nickname on bunks and rafters, lived by the sea, flashed aces in an oasis, down with the devil knows whom and tails on truffles. From the height of a glacier, I beheld half a world, the earthly width. Twice have drowned, thrice let knives rake my nitty gritty, quit the country that bore and nursed me. Those who forgot me would make a city. I have waded the steps that saw yelling Huns in saddles, worn the clothes nowadays back in fashion in every quarter, planted rye, tarred the roofs of pigsties and stables, guzzled everything save dry water. I've admitted the century's third eye into my wet and foul dreams, munched the bread of exile. It's stale and warty. Granted my lungs all sounds except the howl, switched to a whisper. Now I am 40. What should I say about my life? That is long and abhors transparency. Broken eggs make me grieve. The omelet, though, makes me vomit. Yet until brown clay has been rammed down my larynx, only gratitude will be gushing from it.
Joining us now to talk about what we're reading, my colleagues Greg Coles, Tina Jordan, and John Williams. Hey, guys.
Hi, Pamela.
All right, John, let's start with you.
I'm reading a book called Lost Children Archive, which got a lot of attention this year when it was published just a couple months ago, I think, by Valeria Luiselli. And I had read a couple of Luiselli's earlier books. I think one was called Faces in the Crowd, and there was another Slender book. And they were fairly short, very beautiful, very smart, full of great imagery, but a bit oblique and a bit elliptical, which I like, but that's what they were. And looking at this book, which is much longer and seems sort of more ambitious narratively, I wondered if that style would really fit a book like that. And it turns out that she's just doing this totally different thing, which I'm very impressed by and enjoying. I'm about halfway through, which is that she is just telling a bigger story with sort of more traditional digressions and more traditional thoughts about marriage and children and essentially and mostly immigration, because it's set against the border crisis. And it's about two people in New York, a married couple with two children, one each from a previous marriage. And they drive across country. They're two, I think they, I'll get this word wrong, it's like acoustomologists. They take sound recordings for sound documentaries. And the husband is obsessed with the Apaches, and he's very progressive, teaches his kids about, you know, American imperialism and the genocide of Native peoples. And the wife, who's also very liberal, is feeling alienated from him, and she's working on her own project involving lost children, meaning kids who try to immigrate to the United States and get lost in the desert or worse. And they're making these pit stops at motels and at Graceland and at diners, and she's just kind of musing on both the strains in her marriage, the way she's trying to raise her kids, and the way she's trying to teach her kids about how the world can be bad without traumatizing them. It's really great.
One of the things I've been wondering about since you've read the earlier books is those were both, and her other books, published by small independent publishers, written in Spanish and then translated. Mm-hmm. I think this is her second book written in English. And this one is a major publishing house, a very big book in every way. Mm-hmm. Does it feel different? Like, does it feel more commercial, more accessible?
It is more accessible. I don't know how conscious that is as a decision. I think she can just do both registers. It's a little bit insider baseball, but I guess our listeners are pretty insidery at this point. But the other thing was that, yes, this was a book from Knopf, which is sort of one of the most prestigious, large, historic publishers in the United States. And her previous books were with smaller, great presses, but probably didn't have the same expectations for how mm-hmm. well they would sell or the attention they would get. So there is also a sort of satisfying sense of watching a writer take a more ambitious swing and hit the ball. More ambitious is maybe unfair to her, but just a different type of swing and being able to do that too. She's really rising even further in my estimation than she already was.
All right. Over to you, Greg. It looks like you have something also ambitious.
Yeah. Well, you haven't heard me talking about Ulysses for a while, and there is a good reason for that, namely shame. I've pretty much stalled out in the long, very long Night Town section of Ulysses. It's the Circe's section. It is all very hallucinatory and dreamlike. When I first engaged in reading Ulysses, a former teacher of mine, Michael Cunningham, the novelist, said, "I wonder if you'll make it through Night Town." And so far, Michael, the answer is no. But because Mayor Pete Buttigieg, if I said that right.
You did.
Has recently been in the news as a big fan of Ulysses. And he's talked about it as, well, it's a book that really gives you empathy and lets you see that other people are as neurotic as you are, which is all well and good and true as far as it goes. But it doesn't get at the very weirdness of this book. And it sent me back. The fact that Ulysses has been a news story lately sent me back to Ulysses. And I've pushed forward. I'm proud to say that I'm now less than 200 pages from the end of Ulysses, still in the middle of Night Town. I had taken Night Town at the beginning to be a dream sequence and dream sequence from the character, the perspective of Bloom. But it's shifted now to being Stephen Dedalus's dream sequence, which kind of calls into question the whole idea whether it can be a dream at all if it's shifting points of view from one character to another. It ends up in a brothel. And there's such weird stuff. There's gender-bending stuff. At one point, Bloom, who's being cuckolded as this is happening, you know, the proprietor of the brothel is offering to let Bloom peek through the keyhole at his wife, Molly, and her paramour, Blazes Boylan. And at the same time, because of this cuckolding, Bloom is being completely emasculated, and the brothel's madam is turning into a male pimp, and Bloom himself is turning into a woman wearing skirts, and Bella, who's the madam, becomes Bello, the pimp, and is offering to pimp Bloom, who's now a woman, out to the Johns at this brothel. So it's all very kind of phantasmagoric and hallucinatory. And then it shifts, and you're suddenly in Stephen's point of view. So I'm making tiny, tiny progress. I will get to it. I'm feeling a little bit competitive now with Mayor Pete. And I need that competition to keep reading a book like this. Where I stalled out and it was just reading it on my own. At the same time, I've also turned to a book that I had started a few years ago and had to put down for other reasons. It's a book called Goodbye Vitamin by a woman named Rachel Kong. Her previous book before this was a nonfiction book in praise of the egg. And it might help you to know that Rachel Kong is a former editor-at-large at the food magazine Lucky Peach, which I think it is no longer with us. It was this kind of lovely, literary,
beautiful
magazine devoted to food, but all about kind of good writing. And Rachel Kong went on the side and wrote this novel that was about a young woman at kind of loose ends. Her engagement has just broken off, and her father is developing dementia, probably Alzheimer's, although you can't tell that until an actual autopsy. And her mother asks her to stay home with him for the year to kind of keep an eye on things. And the reason that I put the book down when I first started reading it is that back in my writing school days, I was working on a novel about a young woman at loose ends who takes a year off to go look after her father with Alzheimer's. And I just thought, oh, no, I can't read this book that was so much like mine. But in fact, it's nothing at all like mine. It's completely different tone, completely different plots, you know, except for those surface similarities. And I'm really enjoying it. She is, as a debut novelist and a fairly young woman, I think she's still in her 30s, she just seems like a really promising voice. It's written as journal entries, and so it's got this built-in, almost epistolary format. It's just kind of great conversational humor, observational humor. It's a very light book, considering that it's taking on quite a heavy subject.
Tina, you're not reading anything light.
I'm not reading anything light. It's almost not like really reading. It's sort of like looking. I have The Magic of Handwriting, which is the catalog that accompanied an exhibit at the Morgan Library, which is just a few blocks from here, which I think, Greg, you said you saw.
I did. I loved that exhibit.
Right. And it was just between 100 and 200 examples of people's signatures and handwriting.
Yeah, letters and journals. And even like things like the dog license applications.
Right. Signed photos, yeah. Right. Contracts, you know, leases.
Yeah.
There's just all kinds of things in here. How Stephen Hawking signed his books as a thumbprint.
It was not just writers, but scientists and musicians and politicians.
Right. Actually, I'm going to read from the table of contents because that makes it easier. So it's divided into chapters: art, history, 20th century Europe, literature, science, music, philosophy, exploration, entertainment.
Yeah.
I always have had an interest in font. I'm one of those people who always is careful about the font that I choose.
I love font and typefaces.
I do too, but I also am interested in handwriting, and I've become even more interested in it at the Times because there are so many archival stories about 19th century signature and handwriting. And as you know, I'm a big archives fiend.
We did articles about 19th century handwriting?
In the 19th century, for example, famous people, like many of the people in this book, to have their handwriting, to own a piece of it, was so desired that at libraries, when famous writers had signed the book plates of books they donated, people would rip them out. Like, it was a big scandal. Like, if you were famous in any way, people wanted to collect your handwriting.
It'd be like having a lock of your hair.
Yeah, like a lock of your hair. But apparently, a lot of books were destroyed, like, during that time.
I have to say, going to the Morgan exhibition when it was on, you do feel that something's been lost in the typewriter age because there's this kind of direct line between the brain and the page with the handwriting. You see it in the spark of the moment.
Well, there are studies that show that when you write something by hand, as opposed to typing or keyboarding, as they now call it, showing my age, you both acquire and retain the information better than had you keyboarded
right.
it.
Hmm. Now, let me ask you a question. You've each got kids. What are their signatures like?
I feel lucky. My kids have all learned cursive. So for them, a signature means cursive writing, which they do slowly and laboriously, you know, and mock my signature, which they think is, you know, just sloppy and dreadful.
My kids' signatures are as different as my kids' personalities. And my son, who's 16, would really, if he could get away with just typing his name rather than signing it, I think he would do that. He is very much a keyboarder. My middle child, a daughter, she's got lovely handwriting and almost calligraphy, the way that she does her name, with the scrolls and everything. Mm-hmm. And the youngest is only 10, so I think we're still waiting to see what her signature will turn out to be.
What's your signature like, Tina?
It's degenerated over the years, I'll say. It used to be much clearer than it is now. But anyway, so this book, also it takes me back to like letter writing. I love reading letter collections, and a lot of these are letters.
Yeah.
And you forget how, you know, if Winston Churchill was going to be at Checkers while his wife was in the city, he would sit down and write Clemmy a letter a few times a week.
And James Joyce is in there, if I'm not wrong.
Yes, James Joyce is in there as well.
Writing about wanting to be a musician.
Right. One of my favorites is the Hemingway one, and it's written when Hemingway is 12 years old. And he's writing his father a note, and he says,
"Oh, I remember.
Dear Daddy, I feel a lot better when all my work is done and my conscience is clear. You can tell somebody's just gotten in trouble. I looked up in my baseball schedule and found out that the New York Giants will play Chicago." You know, he's like, "Hey, Dad, take me to a ball game."
And it was good.
Yeah, right. So it really does run the gamut. I'm sure you probably hadn't seen any of those things before. I know I hadn't.
Yeah.
Anyway, fascinating. So if anybody else has a handwriting and type, you know, obsession like I do, this is a book for you.
What's the name of it again?
So it's called The Magic of Handwriting, and it's from the Morgan Library and Museum. Pamela, what are you reading?
Journalists are famous for being narcissistic and navel-gazy and love to read books about other journalists and about themselves. And I've actually been pretty negligent on that front. I don't live up to that.
Not narcissistic enough?
No, I've never read the Gay Talese book about the New York Times. I've read a couple of books about the Washington Post, Katharine Graham's memoir, Ben Bradley's memoir. But if anything, for as much about sort of their lives and the periods in which they lived as for their professions. And I picked up a book that is the opposite of that. It's about the New York Times, and it's not a pretty look at the New York Times. So it's one of those books that you don't want to walk around the New York Times carrying it.
And yet here you are on the podcast.
And yet here I am announcing to listeners and any of my colleagues who may be listening. But actually, it was a colleague who mentioned that she was reading this, and I thought, I have that book at home, and I picked it up. The book is called Hard News, 21 Brutal Months at the New York Times and How They Changed the American Media by Seth Mnuchin. And I read it, I guess, as a journalist would in, you know, a few hours. It was like a day, because it is really juicy and terrible. This is the story of the period at the New York Times during which Howell Raines was the executive editor and Jason Blair, who was a fabulist and plagiarist and really serial compulsive pathological, probably, liar, was caught plagiarizing and fabricating stories in the Times. And this subsequently, through a series of events, led to Howell Raines and his managing editor, Gerald Boyd, leaving the paper. And ultimately, Joe Lelyveld, who had been the previous executive editor, sort of taking over temporarily, and then Bill Keller becoming the new editor of the New York Times. This was in the early aughts. And
this is about 2004, right?
Yes.
This happened after I was hired by the Times and before I started at the Times. So I watched it unfolding in real time with kind of horror and thinking, what am I getting into?
Welcome to your workplace. Yeah. What was most interesting to me was, frankly, the depiction of how different journalism was not that long ago. You know, the internet was there. There was a mini journalism recession after 9/11, which people don't really remember, because 9/11 was such a cataclysmic event that journalists really excelled at covering. Yet in the wake of 2001, in about 2002, 2003, there was a media recession. And I remember Time Magazine had a hiring freeze. A number of magazines went under. One of the places that went under was a website called Inside.com, together with this magazine, Brill's Content, where I actually very briefly worked alongside the author of this book, Seth Mnookin. So I was aware early on of this book. But what's so interesting about it is that this is the beginning of the era in which the internet is starting to make an impact on journalism, but it hasn't quite yet fully made its presence known. And so the way in which the newsroom is staffed and functions still operates largely along the lines of a print organization. And to, you know, be sort of pushed off to the work on the website was the equivalent of being assigned to the Westchester edition of, you know, the New York Times. It was just like nowhere you wanted to be if you were an ambitious journalist on the rise. So it was a fun, juicy kind of peek at the past, the not so distant past. All right, let's run down the books again. Greg, what did you read?
Goodbye, Vitamin, a novel by Rachel Khong, that's K-H-O-N-G, and Ulysses by James Joyce.
And Tina?
Well, I can't say I read it, but I've been perusing The Magic of Handwriting, which is from the Morgan Library and Museum.
And John?
I read Lost Children Archive by Valeria Luiselli.
And I read Hard News by Seth Mnookin. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. I write back, albeit not right away. The Book Review Podcast is produced by Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media, with the great help of my colleague, John Williams. Thanks for listening. For The New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.